Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050580, A.G. Edwards & Sons, Inc. versus Maria Alicia Beyer from El Paso County and the 8th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 050478, Southwestern Bell Telephone Company versus Marketing on Hold, Inc., DBA Southwest Tariff Analyst from Cameron County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 060074, Pastor Rick Barr and Philemon Homes, Inc., versus the City of Senton from San Patricio County in the 13th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. We should conclude all arguments before noon today. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050580, A.G. Edwards & Sons versus Maria Alicia Beyer.
Good morning. May it please the court. When the Court of Appeals to reach its holding must add words to one statute and omit the entire last phrase from another statute, that's a pretty good indication that the court's holding is wrong. But before I address the statutory construction issue in this case, I'd like to get a potential red herring out of the way. The court need not decide in this case whether to recognize a lost document exception to Section 439 of the Probate Code. Why? Because Ms. Beyer has never argued for a lost document exception to the statute. Instead, she contends that this case falls within a loophole such that Section 439 simply doesn't apply. But whether or not to recognize a lost document exception is not an issue before the court. Now, in Stouffer versus Henderson, the court held that under Section 439 of the Probate Code, extrinsic evidence is not admissible to create a right of survivorship in a joint account. The only way to establish survivorship rights is to produce a signed writing complying with Section 439 of the Probate Code. And the trial court and the Court of Appeals in this case, however, permitted Ms. Beyer to use extrinsic evidence to persuade the jury, one, that her father intended to leave her.
Well, is that because there were some lost documents by the bank? Do you think that had anything to do with the allowing of that evidence that otherwise perhaps would not have been admissible?
Position was that Section 439 ought not to apply in this situation because, as she contends, that the bank lost this document.
As I read the file, I thought there was some agreement as to the document being misplaced.
No,
the bank's employee.
There is not. They kind of portray it that way, but that's not what the evidence is in this case, Your Honor. The evidence is that it was disputed whether the bank lost this document. I want to make that point very clear because it does come across that way in the Court of Appeals opinion and in some of the briefing. But we dispute that we lost that document. She put on extrinsic evidence to say that her father signed this document, that she took it to the bank, but there was nobody from the bank who said, yes, we got the document. There is some testimony that they try to characterize that way from Mr. Niemeyer, the broker. But what he said was, when she came to the bank and said, where are the documents? He said he went and he checked and he found the only thing he looked for was called a cash convenience account. It's a check writing authorization. He said, once I found that, that's all I needed. He never said, oh, I found the joint account agreement that she says was lost. And we put on evidence that we turned the place upside down looking for that document and never found it. So there is a dispute about
that. The check agreement was the document that he found in his desk? Or is that something different?
He went to the front portion of the office to find the cash writing or the check, the cash convenience account, I think they call it, the check writing authorization. That's where he found that.
But there's no dispute that a right of survivorship account was not created. I mean, they concede that, don't they?
Well, they do. That's right, Your Honor. They take that position. But I think what's important, because what they're going to argue to you is that, well, we didn't use extrinsic evidence to prove survivorship rights.
Isn't this more in the nature of a malpractice or negligence sort of claim as opposed to you know, we agree that we didn't touch the basis, so we don't have an account, but you said you would give us that kind of account, and you messed it up, so you should have some liability for that.
That's their position, Your Honor. And what they said, and they'll tell you, we didn't use extrinsic evidence to try to prove survivorship rights in a joint account. But they did, Your Honor, because what they did was they used extrinsic evidence. Their extrinsic evidence was Alicia Baer and Mr. Baer's housekeeper, Nora Aldaba. They testified that they took home this joint account agreement and that Mr. Baer signed that agreement and that it had survivorship rights in it and thereby created survivorship rights in Alicia Baer. So they used extrinsic evidence to establish that she had survivorship rights in his account. Then they take the position that we destroyed those survivorship rights by losing the document. So that's a key point, that they did use extrinsic evidence here.
Well, let me just ask you this. Let's take as true, and I understand you're disputing some of these facts, but take as true that the bank did, in fact, lose a signed written agreement. What would be the recourse against the bank in that situation?
The recourse, here's the answer to that question, Your Honor, is that it depends on what the courts do with a potential loss document exception. I think as the law stands now under Section 439, if there's an allegation that the bank, it's always going to be a case where the plaintiff says the bank lost the document, and then they've got to prove it. How can they prove it? Well, they need extrinsic evidence to do that. But Section 439 says, no, you can't use extrinsic evidence. You have to have a written document. So, and that's their position is, well, that's just not fair. But that's the way the statute operates. So what we need is one of two things. If this is a real problem, banks losing documents.
No, let's just take as a hypothetical, bank lost the document.
Right. They have no recourse under the law as it stands unless there are two unpublished cases where the courts allowed extrinsic evidence to prove up a lost document. Now, those were not lawsuits against the bank. The other way that they could, if the bank loses the document, the other recourse is for the legislature to create a lost document exception. Now, why do I say the legislature instead of the courts? Because the legislature has enacted statutes providing, allowing parties to prove up lost documents. There's Section 85 of the probate code that allows proof of a lost
will. But, I mean, do you think that's what the legislature really intended in the probate code? I mean, let's say that there's a fire that breaks out in the document room, and all of a sudden all these agreements are destroyed. Then you would say everybody whose agreement was destroyed loses their right of survivorship.
Well, that would be a different situation than here where there's a claim against the bank for negligence. Let's say, I guess they could sue the bank and say you were negligent in allowing this fire to occur.
What is a hurricane like Hurricane Katrina or some other man-made or natural event?
That's right. And the courts may recognize a lost document exception, which is a dicey proposition because once you do that, you open up the banks to all kinds of extrinsic evidence where the party can come in and say, well, we had a lost document here, so you paid the wrong people. And there could be all kinds of circumstances beyond the ones that you're thinking.
That's what happened in Bank America versus Hague, right?
That's what happened in Bank of America versus Hague. What needs to happen here probably is for the legislature to create a lost document exception. They've done it in other instances for lost wills and lost negotiable instruments. And the reason the legislature should do it is because there are a lot of unforeseeable problems to creating a lost document exception, and so the legislature can take testimony from participants in the industry, law professors, and other experts who can say, here's situations where you would want to allow extrinsic evidence to prove up a lost document, maybe the fire at the bank situation. Here are situations where it shouldn't be allowed, and they can set a standard of proof, and they can apply the statute to particular situations.
But couldn't Section 439 be read to be limited to ownership disputes between parties to the account, which is not the issue here?
No, Your Honor, it can't for two reasons. And this is what I opened with, is to get to that conclusion, the Court of Appeals had to do two, I think, remarkable things. First, they had to add words to Section 439, and we've talked about that in our brief, how they added an entire phrase to make it seem like this statute only applies in a suit against the decedent survivors. Next, and this is the most remarkable part, they relied on Section 437 to say that it doesn't apply in this situation. And the court, without any ellipsis points or any other indication that it was doing so, dropped off the entire last phrase of Section 437. And that entire last phrase is key here because what it says is 437 says, the provisions of sections 438 through 440 that concern beneficial ownership are only relevant to controversies between their persons, between these persons.
You left out as between parties.
Well, I was just trying to be quick about my recitation, but as between parties, but what I want to get to is the last phrase that they court dropped off, and have no bearing on the power of withdrawal of these persons as determined by the terms of the account contracts. Now, the Court of Appeals just dropped that entire last phrase, put a period, acted like that section or that phrase didn't exist. Why? Because that phrase makes it very clear what Section 437 is trying to do. It's saying that banks, you can, and financial institutions, you can rely on the account agreements to determine who has survivorship rights.
Suppose a customer goes into a bank and says, I want to set up a joint account with right of survivorship. How do I do that? And the bank employee says, well, this is how you do it. And there's no question about this, or it's tape recorder or something, so that there's no doubt that this is what happened. And the banker gives bad advice. He says, well, you should fill out this form or do this, but they forget to check it, or they don't use the right language or something. And the customer makes very clear, now, this is what I want, and I'm depending on you to advise me here. And so it doesn't happen. So the account is not set up correctly. Does the bank have any liability for that?
The bank doesn't have liability for that, Your Honor, because it requires extrinsic evidence, unreliable extrinsic evidence of a plaintiff coming into court and saying, well, this is what happened, and the bank officer saying, no, that's not what happened.
But if, I suppose, if the customer goes in and says, I need you to wire this money to this escrow agent by such and such time, otherwise I'm going to lose this deal, and the bank says, fine, we'll do that, and they don't do it, I suppose they'd have some liability in that situation, wouldn't they?
Yes, and the reason...
It's hard to see the difference.
Well, the reason is, as you explained in Stouffer versus Henderson, and that's explained in the probate code, the uniform probate code, in order for banks to be induced to provide these joint account agreements with rights of survivorship, they need a great deal of certainty about their liability. And because if there are situations where parties can come in with extrinsic evidence, something besides a writing and saying, besides a writing and allege that, well, I did have survivorship rights and you botched it, then the banks aren't going to want to offer these agreements, or if they continue to do so, then what they'll do is just interplead the funds in every case until they have absolute certainty that there is no outstanding potential claim that could be based on extrinsic evidence.
But how does an interpleader help you in this case?
Interpleader,
because if the parties agreed that there was no agreement, you still end up with the complaint that you did not, that you lost the agreement. So how does an interpleader help you in a situation like this?
In a situation like this, it probably wouldn't help us, but banks are going to take the most cautious approach that they can find under the law. And I want to give the court one hypothetical that I think demonstrates why the statute applies to this situation, why it's inherent in the statute. Let's take this hypothetical. Nephew tape records a telephone conversation with uncle. Uncle says, I'm going down to the bank right now, and I'm going to open up a joint account, and I'm going to give you survivorship rights. It's a tape recorded conversation. Uncle goes down to the bank. He changes his mind, and he fills out just a plain old joint account agreement, no survivorship rights. Then uncle dies. The bank takes a look at the account documents and decides, okay, there's no survivorship rights here. So they give the money to uncle's heirs. Nephew then comes into court and he sues and says, I had survivorship rights in that account, and you paid the wrong people, so you owe me damages, and I can prove it with this tape recording. Well, the bank moves for summary judgment because under Section 439, the tape recording is not admissible.
And the motion should be granted.
Motion should be granted. So
if
then
the tape recording was between the bank officer and the and the customer instead of between these people who, I agree, could change their mind, that seems to make it worse.
It would, but I think that's a situation that the legislature may need to address with perhaps a lost document exception.
Let's go back to the lost document. You say it's disputed that the joint account agreement was lost by A.G. Edwards. The respondent says, pointing to some record sites, that Niemeyer found the documents, including the joint account agreement, showed them to the plaintiff, buyer. So is it disputed that A.G. Edwards had the joint account agreement at some point in time properly executed by the buyers?
Yes, Your Honor, very much so.
How so? If Niemeyer said he had them and showed them to buyer after she signed them?
That's a mischaracterization a little bit of the evidence. But that's Alicia Byer's testimony about what happened with Mr. Niemeyer. She said she went into the office. He went to, and she said, why isn't the account set up? And he said, well, you didn't give me the documents back. And then she says, yes, I did. So he says, let me go check. And he comes back and he says, okay, I found the documents. We're fine. So their characterization of that is that it included the joint account agreement. But Mr. Niemeyer testified when he went back there, the only thing that he looked for was this cash writing check convenience account, this cash writing check writing authorization, and that's all he found, not the joint account agreement. So it is disputed.
And the jury found to the contrary, though, against A.G. Edwards, implicitly at least.
That they didn't, Your Honor, because we objected. At the charge stage, our first objection was we object to the omission of a question asking whether or not there was ever a signed joint account agreement that was lost by A.G. Edwards. And over our objection, they refused to submit that question. So there can be no deemed or implied finding that there was a lost document that was signed by Mr. Byer and that A.G. Edwards lost.
Going back to your taping hypo, so if the bank itself had not just audio taped, but maybe videotaped the entire series of back and forth transactions, including maybe even capturing on videotape the executed documents, even that would be inadmissible?
I think under the law as it stands, it might be. Now, the court could certainly...
Might be...
Inadmissible. Inadmissible. But the court could certainly recognize a lost document exception for that situation if the court felt comfortable that it was not intruding on the legislative domain or that wouldn't create unforeseeable problems. But it's probably a situation best addressed by the legislature for the reasons I pointed out. And they've never asked for a lost document exception to Section 439, because if they had one, then they wouldn't have a claim against us, because when she settled with her brothers and sisters, that would have waived any claim against us. We couldn't have caused her damages because she could have relied on this lost document exception.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. The court is now ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Angela Nicky for Alicia Byer. As Justice Jefferson's question indicated, Alicia Byer does not believe that Section 439A of the
Probate. Ms. Nicky, I'm sorry, we can barely hear you.
Can you
just speak a little louder, please?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Alicia Byer does not believe that Section 439A of the Probate Code should apply in this case. The reason being, as this court has said, the purpose of the multi-party account provisions in the probate code, can you hear me now? Thank you.
A little better.
Is to protect financial institutions from becoming involved in disputes between parties as to the beneficial ownership of joint accounts. But in this case, Alicia Bayer's claims against A.G. Edwards has nothing to do with a dispute among the parties to the account. Alicia Byer has recognized that because there is no joint account agreement, the only agreement that the bank had that would have the appropriate survivorship language, she had no right to claim survivorship as against her father's estate.
What's your position on this parole evidence issue and this lost document exception?
In this case, Alicia Byer could not have used a lost document exception to prove against her father's estate. And I don't think the court has to reach that issue because Alicia Bayer's claims against A.G. Edwards are about a lost document, failure to maintain the documents, and failure to assure that an account actually operated as the depositor had requested.
But it seems to me that if we follow the strict language of this statute that under no circumstance can parole evidence ever be used against a bank in this type of situation?
That's correct. To prove survivorship as against the estate of the deceased party.
Then how do you prevail?
This is not a case in which Alicia Bayer is attempting to prove that she had survivorship rights. And no court has ever applied Section 439A in a situation outside where a bank or a party was needing to determine what the survivorship rights were. Instead, Alicia Bayer's case is about the bank's liability for its own negligence, malfeasance, breaches of contract, and failing to maintain the document and failing to assure that the account operated as requested.
Well, how do you prove that without this evidence being admitted, which is parole evidence?
Our position is that Section 439A does not bar parole evidence or evidence of the decedent's intent in a case that is not about the ownership of the account. And that is because Section 437, as stated earlier, talks about that the probate code sections 438 through 440 have to do with the relationship between the parties to the account and are relevant only to controversies between those persons. On the other hand, the legislature has actually segregated the multi-party account provisions of the probate code into two sections. The first, which is 438 through 440, deal with the relationship between the parties to the account. The second is 444 through 449, which deal with the depositor financial institution relationship. This is a depositor financial institution relationship cause of action. Because there is no prohibition in that section, those sections, anywhere in section 444 through 449 for a bank to, there's no provision to protect a bank from the liability for maintaining an account as the depositor requested. Had the legislature intended to provide protections to a bank in a multi-party account situation, had intended to relieve it of any obligation to keep and maintain documents so that an account would operate as intended, it could have done so. It did not. Similarly, there is no evidentiary bar, as there is in Section 439A, in any of Section 444 through 449 that deal with the depositor financial institution relationship. Had the legislature
intended...
But the point
of prescribing this language that has to be used mm-hmm. to create this kind of account
correct.
Is to avoid disputes over this. And it seems to me that your position completely circumvents that. And now you can get around that provision of the statute by simply alleging that the bank was negligent.
You can't get around.
And worst of all, is then the bank has to pay twice or almost twice, whereas before there was a big fuss, but the money was only going to be paid once.
That's correct. And the bank pays twice because it is the bank's negligence in losing the document. The bank pays out in this
dispute
case.
Dispute about that. We're trying to avoid disputes. So we're trying to avoid, you know, the possible in this case that the daughter went home, asked her father to sign it, he changed his mind, said, no, I'm not going to sign that. And so now the only way to get the $1 million is to say that he did sign it, and I brought it back to the bank.
That's correct. The legislature intended, I believe, to protect banks, as it says, from getting involved in disputes among the parties to the account. The legislature did not intend to protect the bank against this kind of dispute. And if there is to be such protection for a bank when it is in the financial institution depositor relationship, Alicia Bayer versus A.G. Edwards, not Alicia Bayer versus her siblings through her father's estate, then the legislature should provide that protection. It is our belief that reading the statutes, the legislature did not provide that protection.
Jury question one asks, did the negligence of any of the persons named below proximately cause the absence of the written account agreement providing for rights of survivorship? The jury said yes, that A.G. Edwards was negligent in that regard, and that your client was negligent in that regard.
That's correct.
What was the evidence that the written documentation of survivorship rights was properly executed and in the hands of A.G. Edwards?
Alicia Bayer, well, first, Mr. Niemeyer testified that he had prepared the joint account agreement so that it would be providing rights of survivorship to Alicia Bear.
Who said that?
Mr. Niemeyer, the A.G. Edwards account executive. Alicia Bear testified that she took the documents home to her father and that they discussed them. He understood what the right of survivorship would be and that he signed them, she signed them, and they returned them to A.G. Edwards. Nora Aldaba, who was Mr. Bear's housekeeper, also testified that she saw the documents signed.
How do you know she she was seen? She didn't read English. As I understand, didn't read English or speak English.
You have to take Mr. Niemeyer, for Nora Aldaba's testimony to be valid, you have to take Mr. Niemeyer's testimony and Nora Aldaba's testimony sort of together. Mr. Niemeyer did say that he prepared the documents so that there would be a right of survivorship. Alicia Bear testified that there were no changes made to the documents, they were just signed. And Nora Aldaba testified that she did see the documents being signed, three documents being signed, and that she herself took the documents in an envelope and turned them in to A.G. Edwards.
To whom at A.G. Edwards?
She asked for Mr. Niemeyer. Mr. Niemeyer was not available, and so the receptionist in the front said that she would take the documents, and Ms. Aldaba left.
As I understand it, later Mr. Niemeyer said he didn't think they had the documents, and there was a search.
Yes, Mr. Niemeyer testified that he, Alicia Bear testified that she came back to check on the account and that she saw the joint account agreement and the other two documents, that she saw all three documents. Mr. Niemeyer denied that that visit ever happening and said that he never did search for the documents or find the documents before Mr. Bear's death.
Is there any dispute that the account funds belong to the decedent before he
No.
died?
What were the damages for?
The damages were 5/6 of the account. Ms. Bear claimed that she lost 5/6 of the account because she had to share with her siblings through intestate succession. She had five siblings when the account should have been completely hers.
And would you address counsel's comment about the refusal to submit a question about were the documents lost? Was there a lost document?
A.G. Edwards hasn't raised that point on appeal. When we were at trial, we believed that the absence of the documents was the appropriate question. This was an unusual case. We believe that was there fault for the absence of the documents, and whose fault was that?
Did they ask for a question?
I don't recall whether the question was submitted or not.
Are these kinds of documents effective when signed or when delivered to an authorized bank officer?
Well, there is some evidence in the case that it would be that the documents would not be valid until they went to the home office. Alicia Bear asked for copies of her documents, and she testified that Niemeyer told her, I will send you copies after they've been approved by home office. That's why she didn't keep copies in the first place. I'm not sure when the document would be effective. Clearly, if you had a signed document at your home and you never returned it to the bank, as is A.J. Edwards claiming this case, the bank would have no idea what you wanted in your account, and the bank would not be liable for a document it never, failing to interpret a document it never received.
But at least it's your understanding that it had to be approved in the home office?
That was our understanding from Alicia Bear's testimony, yes, that she was told not to keep a copy of, she didn't need to keep a copy of the documents because it would have to be approved by home office.
So really, lots of siblings have disputes about assets, especially when it's $1 million in cash. And one of them's usually taking care of mom or dad. And what keeps every one of them from saying, you know, you could have a rule that you have to keep copies. No, well, they told me I didn't have to keep it. Well, what's to keep every one of the siblings from saying, I signed it all and gave it to them. They must have just lost it.
There's nothing to keep that kind of claim. I don't believe there's anything in the probate code that protects a bank from that kind of claim. Simply, my answer would be that's what juries are for, and there's nothing in the probate code that prevents
that
provision.
No, we have rules like the statute of frauds because we think more people are going to lie about you promised to give me your house then are going to actually lose the writing where they gave them the house. And if I had to guess, are you likely to have more siblings lie about daddy wanted to leave everything to me versus banks who threw away the account agreements? I'm guessing there's going to be more of the former than the latter.
There may be, but that protection from that kind of claim is simply not in the probate code, and certainly not in Section 439A, because 439A applies between the parties to the account. And I think it's important to note here, 439A was A.G. Edwards' only objection under the probate code in this case. A.G. Edwards never raised any of the other 440 through 449, any other type of protections to the trial court or to the Court of Appeals. This was simply an evidentiary objection.
This account started out as a joint account with right of survivorship between these two parties, correct?
At one time, yes.
And then when she became a resident alien, in order to protect the funds for tax purposes, she was taken off the account.
That's correct. She was placed back on the account.
So that would distinguish her from her siblings in the estate dispute.
That's true. That's
true. There's at least some ambiguity about whether 439 governs here or not and whether extrinsic evidence comes in or not. Wouldn't it be prudent for the court to just follow its ruling in the prior case? What's it?
Stouffer.
And then let the legislature conduct hearings where, you know, bank examiners testify and the public testifies and then write a rule if they think it's appropriate to permit this kind of evidence in a case not involving a dispute between the putative owners but involving a case like this.
I think the important distinction there is Section 437. Section 439A simply does not apply in the banking institution depositor relationship. It is relevant only when there's a dispute among the parties. And that is not to say that banks aren't entitled to rely on it. When the bank is faced, it has its document, and it is faced with a claim that the bank paid the wrong party by a sibling or another family member, the bank has the document, and it can sort out that claim. It can defend itself, certainly, and nothing in the Court of Appeals opinion keeps that from happening. It can defend itself and say, we paid the correct party because here's the document, there were no rights of survivorship, there were rights of survivorship, and it can defend those kinds of claims, and nothing in the Court of Appeals opinion diminishes that protection, and that was protection that was intended for the banks. This, however, is a completely separate cause of action. There is no dispute over the ownership of the funds. And Lisa Bayer, unfortunately, had to recognize that.
We do have to reverse the attorney's fees award under Gullo Motors versus CHOPPA.
Correct. I believe that we're the new standard.
And which parts do you agree CHOPPA requires to be segregated out and which parts not?
I believe that some, but not all, of the separate federal court proceeding may need to be segregated. That was such an unusual use of that federal court proceeding that I believe most of it would be permissible because Alicia Bayer had to, it was not just an interpleader, it was also a request for injunction.
She got attorney's fees in the federal court.
No, sir, she did not. The federal court, in the end, was awarding attorney's fees, but did not award Alicia Bayer her attorney's fees because she had been awarded them in the state court.
Is that all?
That's correct. But I think the use of that interpleader cause of action to try to include an injunction and try to stop the state court proceeding makes this akin to a situation where a party has to defeat a counterclaim in order to protect their contract cause of action. Alicia Bayer had to go over to the federal court and fight the injunction. And that really was most of it, but I believe that some of that would have to be segregated. The rest of the case, this is really just one transaction, and it's one story that needed to be told and discovered from start to finish. It may present a somewhat unusual situation, but simply, as the court said here, simply because some legal services advance recoverable and unrecoverable claims, they're not disallowed simply because they do double duty. And in telling this one story that needed to be told anyway to understand the context and the whole, to understand all of the facts, most of those facts also supported the other causes of action. There was not really a separate, independent basis for fraud, or a basis for breach of fiduciary duty, or a basis for negligence.
Well, except by the time all this went to trial, you'd gotten all the money from the bank. They'd interpled it.
Lisa Bayer had received... No, actually not. The federal interpleader was not finished until, I believe, a month or a month and a half. But the final order was in September, and this case went to trial in August.
And you would say that Section 439 operated properly in that proceeding because it kept any testimony regarding the lost documents out.
Absolutely.
As against the estate.
Absolutely. It was the loss of the document and 439A itself that gave Alicia Bayer this cause of action against the bank. Had the bank not lost the document, we wouldn't be here. We could see what it said. We could decide either Alicia gets the money or she does not, depending on the language, and the case would have been over. However, the bank lost the document and Alicia Bayer...
So what does happen when there are claims from both? The beneficiaries say there was no joint account, and, of course, Bayer does, turns out the bank is just going to have to pay twice, or do they abate one case until the other is decided, or what happens?
I think the appropriate issue would be to abate one case until the other is decided, until the dispute among the parties is decided.
Now, that goes against, I think, the position you've staked here, is that 439A would preclude that sort of debate, period, versus between the parties to the estate.
That's correct, Judge. But I think there would not be a cause of action against the bank until...
But so, because of 439, the bank would definitely have to pay because there is no written document, and then they have to litigate this other and may have to pay twice. And where's the... It can't be both ways. Either there was a joint account with the right of survivorship, right, or there was not.
As among the parties, 439A would apply, absolutely. And if Alicia Bayer had tried to go into federal court and tried to prove up some sort of lost document exception that, of course, doesn't exist, and lost in that case, then she would have a cause of action against the bank for losing the document. In this case, she recognized there's no document. I have no cause of action. I can't go into federal court in bad faith and try to claim against my siblings.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
I'll attempt to answer your question about leaving it up to the legislature. I'm going to finish up with that hypothetical uncle-nephew hypothetical I started with to make the point that what the position we're taking, that 439A applies in this situation, is implicit or inherent in the statutory scheme. And that's what Justice Hecht found when in Stouffer versus Henderson. Section 439A says you have to have it in writing. Well, it didn't say anything in the statute about you can't use extrinsic or parole evidence, but that was inherent and implicit in the statute, and that's what the court held in Stouffer versus Henderson.
Counsel, right? Stouffer did not involve a lost document, did it?
No.
And
no,
Stouffer did not involve a party claiming that the bank committed separate and independent tort by losing the document that created a right of survivorship. Stouffer was exactly a 439A situation where parties were claiming the right to the funds based upon a written right of survivorship agreement that just didn't exist. So Stouffer is not on all fours with this case, is it?
No, it's not on all fours, Your Honor. But the holding in Stouffer applies here through the statutory scheme, and let me explain why by finishing up with that nephew-uncle hypothetical. We already said the nephew says, I want to use this extrinsic evidence, this tape recording, to establish that I have survivorship rights in that money. You paid it to the wrong people, so you owe me damages. The bank gets summary judgment on that because he's attempting to establish survivorship rights. 439 clearly applies. So the nephew goes and he reads the law and he sees that that's right, but then he reads the Bayer case and he says, okay, I'm just going to amend my petition and now I will allege that I should have had survivorship rights and that you guys, the bank, botched the documents and therefore you owe me damages in the amount of the account proceeds.
Again,
and then I can get my
hypothetical
evidence.
Seems so different to me. I mean, let's take another hypothetical. That's an extreme on this side. Let's take a hypothetical where the bank officer says, I lost it. You know, my dog ate it. I really did lose it. I stipulate to that. But you go to trial and you say that stipulation can't come in, that evidence can't come in. That would be the hypothetical on the other side.
Sure. Yes, and if that issue were before this court, then the court might well decide that there should be a lost document exception for that situation. But they have not asked for a lost document exception.
Well, their position is they don't need an exception to 439A because it doesn't apply to this situation because it's an independent claim against the bank for losing the document. It's not a claim for survivorship funds based upon the written agreement.
Exactly. That is exactly
so
right.
They're not seeking an exception, at least not their, that's not their position. That may
right.
be your position.
That's right. They're not seeking one, and that's exactly right.
And back to Justice O'Neill's point, I know you say the fact that A.G. Edwards had the document with the written right of survivorship in it in its possession was disputed, but the jury had to have found that A.G. Edwards had it in its possession, didn't it?
No.
First question... Question one that I read before,
yes,
that said, and combine that with question two, that the jury found that A.G. Edwards was 80% liable in proximately causing the absence of the written agreement in question. How could the jury not have found, at least implicitly, that A.G. had it to have proximately caused its absence?
Okay. I have an answer for that, Your Honor. As a two answers. As a legal matter, because we objected to the omission of that. Question.
And I'm not sure that constitutes a waiver of this point or affects this point, actually.
But let me get to the factual basis for my answer, and that is, and you'll see it throughout their brief, they talk about either we lost the document or we, quote, failed to secure it. Now, what they had two theories of the case. Their primary theory of the case was there was a document and we lost it. Their secondary backup theory was that we should have, we got notice, we got a wire on December 27th that said, from the Home Office that said, where's the joint account agreement? And their theory, their backup theory of the case was that we should have called Alicia Baer and said, hey, you need to get the document in here. And that was one of their theories, and they put on evidence, and it's reflected in their brief, that we should have followed up with Alicia Baer and said, where's the document? You better get it signed. You better get it here.
What would prompt a call from your Home Office?
The Home Office has procedures, and after, I think it's 2 weeks, after an account is opened, if they don't have the account agreement, they send a wire to the broker that says, hey, where's the account agreement? And that's what happened here. So her backup theory was we should have called her and said, hey, you need to get the document in here. So that, Your Honor, is how the jury could have found.
Well, the jury also found in questions 6 and 7 that A.G. Edwards agreed with Alicia Baer and Frederico Baer to open a joint account. The jury said yes, that agreement occurred. That's six. Question seven, the jury said A.G. Edwards failed to comply with that agreement. That's question seven. And in question one, the jury said A.G. Edwards proximately caused the absence of the written agreement that the jury later found A.G. Edwards agreed in terms of opening the account with right of joint survivorship. I'm finding it hard following your contention that the jury did not conclude that A.G. Edwards had the written agreement in its possession after it was executed.
They might have concluded that, or they might have found that we were negligent in failing to follow up, that we breached the contract by failing to carry out the agreement, to open it up as a joint account agreement, by failing to call her and say, you know, where's the document? Get it in here. But as a legal matter, it's very clear that the court cannot be a deemed or implied finding that there was a document that was lost, because it was her burden of proof to get that finding. We objected to its omission, and therefore, without that finding, the court can't just say, well, there's a deemed or implied finding.
Do you argue to the jury that you had not lost the document in closing?
Yes.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.